Good morning. Shadows among shadows. Thank you for manifesting in human form here today to explore the Dharma together. And happy St. Patrick's Day. Just a reminder about Teisho. If you feel the need to shift your posture during a Teisho, please feel free to do so. But please do it quietly and unobtrusively. And however you sit, keep the back straight and the head up. A Teisho is not just a talk. It is not an attempt to convey information or to be a lecture. It's an attempt by the teacher or whoever's giving the talk to express the Dharma as directly as it can be done in language and words. So, in listening to a Teisho, please don't try to analyze or understand it in the usual way. Simply listen with an open mind and an open heart. Let the words come into you, and without trying to judge or make opinions about them, or even to understand in the usual way. This morning, we chanted the lines, "Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form." To be a little less abstract, we could also say that life is only death. Death is only life. Form, existence, being, all arise with birth. Life, rivers, mountains, trees, humans, animals, birds, insects, clouds, the sky, the stars, galaxies, novas, and supernovas, all arise at birth, and all pass away at death. And yet, birth and death, life and death, are not at all separate. The Buddha said, "Not in the sky, nor in the midst of the ocean, nor deep in the mountains, nowhere can you hide from your own death." Khalil Gibran put it rather more directly. I said to life, I would hear death speak. And life raised her voice a little higher and said, "You hear him now." If we look carefully at these two quotes, what do we see? The Buddha and Gibran are not looking at death as a future catastrophe, but as here and now reality. You cannot hide anywhere from your own true nature. You cannot hide from your own death. You hear him now. Most of us, certainly in this tradition, are willing to acknowledge death, at least intellectually. The great matter of birth and death is, after all, what brings us to practice. But are we really honest with ourselves about our inevitable death? We love life. We fear death. We think we understand and experience life. We think that we don't understand death and will not experience it until it happens, which we secretly hope is never. We will certainly never get past that fear unless we have a clear understanding of the matter. We speak of facing up to the imminence of death. It is said that death is looking over your shoulder every moment. But death is even closer than that. Death is right here, right now. The ancient saying is, in the midst of life we are in death. If that is the case, then in the midst of death we are in life. It's just as valid. How do we become intimate with death without falling into morbid fears? The fact is, the more intimate we are with death, the less we fear it. Why is death itself beyond experience? Because we have put it there. We separate life and death, and then cling to life and reject death. We consider death to be the ultimate other, utterly outside of human knowing, maybe even an object of terror, to be ignored, denied, or fantasized about with notions of afterlives, heaven, hell, limbo, or reincarnation. In all these cases, death is looked upon as separate in time and therefore in space. It's a future event, always future, until one day it isn't. As long as death remains a concept, a terrifying abstraction, it can never be fully dealt with, and hence all the metaphysical speculations about death. Does the soul leave the body? Is the soul separate from the body? What happens after you die? Is there a heaven or a hell? What is their structure? And who decides who goes where? There are incredibly elaborate schemes developed by most organized religions around what happens when you die. One of the most well-known schema of the afterworld is Dante's Divine Comedy, in which he describes in mind-boggling detail a trip through hell, purgatory, and heaven, all with many levels or circles populated by the good, the bad, and the ugly. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, you have the bardos, a series of states that one passes through after death on the way to rebirth. Then there are the stories of Valhalla, the halls of feasting and drinking in the Nordic traditions, paradise and 72 virgins in Islam, and so on. I don't know that anyone seriously thinks about growing wings and hanging out in some sort of cloud-bedecked heaven playing a harp. And there's the matter of reincarnation. A soul proceeding from life to life, upwards or downwards, depending on how we have lived. Even in our tradition, it's easy to conflate the principle of rebirth with notions of some entity continuing after the dissolution of the body-mind. Nevertheless, all the scriptural accounts, the speculations, the talk of near-death experiences or LSD trips do not approach the experiential reality. All these do is generate knowing. Knowing in the worldly sense of time, space, and karma. As soon as someone says, "I know," they've lost it, even if they had ever realized it in the first place. A monk named Malunkyaputta was concerned with such questions, so he put them to the Buddha. Are the soul and the body the same? Is the soul one thing and the body another? Is the world eternal or not? After death, does a Tathagata exist or not? The Buddha refused to answer such cosmological questions about life and death, afterlife, the soul, or the existence of the Tathagata, or of anyone, after death. Instead, he replied with the famous parable of the poisoned arrow. Suppose, Malunkyaputta, a man were wounded by an arrow, thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon to treat him. The man would say, "I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker." And he would say, "I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know the name of the clan of the man who wounded me, until I know whether the man who wounded me was tall or short or of middle height, until I know whether the man who wounded me was dark or brown or golden skinned, until I know whether the man who wounded me lives in such a village or town or city, until I know whether the bow that wounded me was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring that wounded me was fiber or reed or sinew or hemp or bark, until I know whether the shaft that wounded me was wild or cultivated, until I know with what kind of feathers that shaft that wounded me was fitted, whether those of a vulture or a heron or a hawk or a peacock or a stork, until I know with what kind of sinew the shaft that wounded me was bound, whether that of an ox or a buffalo or a deer or a monkey, until I know what kind of arrowhead it was that wounded me, whether spiked or razor-tipped or curved or barbed or calf-toothed or lancet-shaped." All this would still not be known to that man, and meanwhile he would die. This desire to know stuff, to know about souls and afterlife, all the cosmological questions that so often come up when we begin to contemplate the inevitability of our approaching death. And let's face it, we're approaching death every minute of our lives, leads to all sorts of speculations and imaginings, which in the end are a waste of energy and time. So where does that leave us? The only place these questions can be asked or answered lies in the here and now, in the deep silence, in the spaceless, timeless here and now of our Zazen. The Buddha insisted on, and certainly we insist on it in our tradition, the direct experience of the unknown and unknowable. And to demonstrate that experience in the Dokusan room, and to live that experience as a bodhisattva. Case number 55 in the Blue Cliff Record reads in part: "One day, Dao Wu, accompanied by his disciple Jian Yan, went to pay his condolences at the house of a man who had just died in the neighborhood of their temple. Jian Yan, tapping the coffin, said, 'Alive or dead?' Dao Wu said, 'I won't say alive, and I won't say dead.' Jian Yan said, 'Why won't you say?' Dao Wu said, 'I won't say.' On their way home, Jian Yan said, 'Teacher, if you don't tell me, I will hit you.' Dao Wu said, 'You may hit me if you like, but I won't say.' Jian Yan struck Dao Wu. Dao Wu won't say. Why not? Some say he is forcing Jian Yan to find his own way through life and death. That is undoubtedly true. But he is also saying, 'I can't say.' In fact, no one can say. If you do not experience it directly in this moment, can you say anything about it? Dare you say anything about it?" In the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were not separate. They were not separate from each other, from their work, from the universe, or from God. They were not knowing. But they ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, of knowing, and became separate from everything, self and other estranged. Are you a gambler? Suppose you're at the funeral of someone you know, maybe even a loved one. A stranger comes up to you and says, "Is the one in the coffin alive or dead?" You give the obvious answer. Dead, of course. And the stranger says, how much are you willing to bet? Let's open the coffin. If there's a dead person in there, I'll give you $10 million. But if there is no dead person, you, your family, your spouse and children all become my slaves for life. A sure thing? How many con artists, grifters, and schemers have gotten rich off of some poor sucker's sure thing? You hear an offer like that, and you'd better start to wonder. Well, I know the person is dead, isn't he or she? What if I made a mistake? Did I really see the person die? What if the coffin has a false bottom and someone else is in there? If you're wise and not greedy, you better say no bet. Does anyone ever spot the pea under the shell? Does anyone spot the queen in three-card Monte? If our willingness to take the sure thing seems to be inversely proportional to the consequences of being wrong, maybe we need to look more carefully at our own confidence in the sure thing. Any sure thing. Even the most trivial and obvious ones. If it is not our direct experience here and now, we can say nothing about it. The relationship of speculations and imaginings of the ego self to reality can be summed up in the following anecdote from that great Buddhist scripture, the Reader's Digest. Two gentlemen are riding on a train, or maybe it's a bus. One looks out the window at a field where sheep are grazing. He says to his companion, "Look, those sheep have all just been sheared." His companion looks out the window and says, "Well, they have been on this side anyway." The two men saw exactly the same thing, but the first extrapolated from what he saw to create a reality that was actually not his direct experience. The second saw what he saw and let it remain at that. Our karmic minds are like the first man. Whatever we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, or even think, we assemble into a spurious reality that goes far beyond the direct experience. We create 3D models of what we think of as reality. Not, this is how it is, but this is how I know it is. How I want it to be, how it should be. And when that kind of fantasy is carried to extremes, the result is disaster. When you look at a sheep, you naturally assume that what you see on this side will be what you see on the other side. But in your direct experience, there is no other side. Until you walk around it and look. The walking around and looking is what we usually call an act of discovery. We discover, discover, what we had already decided was there. That is to say, we first created a speculative reality, and then we try to confirm it. But what if you walked around the sheep and discovered that the other side had not been sheared? Now, that situation may seem fairly trivial. You might think, this is weird. Why wouldn't the farmer shear both sides of the sheep and let it go at that? You have no particular investment in whether your speculation about the sheep being sheared was correct or not. On the other hand, suppose you were to walk around the sheep and discover that there really was no other side. Maybe there's only an empty shell of a skeleton. Or maybe you see no sheep, nothing at all. That could blow your mind. Our reaction to the discovery of reality depends on how attached we are to our speculative creations. Not being sheared is no big deal. Not being there at all is something else. How often do we find our knowing and the discovered reality completely at odds? And more important, how do we react? Dealing with the unexpected, accepting the unexpected, is the most important part of dealing with the matter of our lives and of our death. Dao Wu said, "I won't say alive, I won't say dead." Dao Wu does not know. And that is the key here. Not knowing. The great unknown and unknowable that we call death is just the other side of what you see in this moment. So you look at the other side. Oh, there it is. But then where is the first side? Gone. That has become the other side. All that we see shifts and changes with every movement and blink of the eye. You will never see the other side. It is beyond sight, sound, even thought. You can pick up the most trivial object, and you can never know what is on the other side, or even if there is another side, because no matter which way you turn it, you are always only seeing this side. Even when we manipulate thought objects in our minds, we still only see this side. There is always the other side, unknown and unknowable, hidden from our ordinary senses. A spoon, a pen, a cup, or your own hand. What is the other side of my hand? Does it exist or not? I will never, ever know. What is the other side of this lecture? The other side of sound. What is the other side of your breath? Of a thought? You will never, ever know. But if that is so, what about this side? That which we hear, see, smell, taste, touch. Can we really say that we know it? Can the other side really be other? You can't separate the direct experience from the unknown. Consider a door. It has a front and a back. If you try to get rid of the back by shaving away the wood, what happens? The moment the back disappears, so does the front. There can be no front side without a back side. They're not separate. If you try to eliminate death, you eliminate life. They are not separate. Our Dharma father, Dainin Henry Roshi, had a cheap pocket watch which he used in Doksan to illustrate the point. On one side there were hands and numbers, the stuff of time and space. The other side was blank, nothing, but all the same watch. Can I really say I know this side of the lecture? Or my hand? Can I say that it exists? That it doesn't exist? And let's not get into the sophistry like both sides, both exist and doesn't exist, or neither exists nor does, or blah, blah, blah. That just earned you 60 blows. In 1935, the physicist Erwin Schrödinger proposed a thought experiment. A cat is sealed in a box along with a vial of poison gas. There's a mechanism which can smash the vial and kill the cat. The mechanism would be activated by the release of a subatomic particle from a very small bit of a radioactive substance, an entirely random event. As long as the box remains sealed, is the cat alive or dead? The experiment was proposed to deal with quantum mechanics and field theory, but from our standpoint, it is exactly the same as the other side of the sheet or the other side of anything. We cannot say it exists or that it does not exist until we experience it directly. The truth is we all live in Schrödinger's universe. Is the cat in the box alive or dead? We cannot say alive. We cannot say dead until we open the box. Then we discover life or death. Is the other side of the sheet there or not? We cannot say until we walk around it. Absent the direct experience in this moment, you cannot say anything exists or does not exist. In fact, nothing is created. Nothing passes away. There is only change. Marvelous, kaleidoscopic, unknowable, unpredictable transformation. We call it arising and passing away only because of our attachment to some created object. The most solid reality of mountains, rocks, trees, and even people are mind-created illusion. The world is made new each and every moment. To truly live this is to wander the six worlds in a samadhi of innocent delight. No wonder Maitreya is depicted as Hotai, the laughing Buddha. Yongja says, the real nature of ignorance is the Buddha nature itself. The empty delusory body is the very body of the Dharma. When the Dharma body awakens completely, there is nothing at all. We live a profound, unfathomable mystery. It is awesome. And yes, it can be terrifying. But this great mystery is right before you. Every moment is brand new. Never seen before, never to be seen again. You no longer fall into the memory trap. Been there, done that. The endless boredom or constant restlessness of looking for something new in the trivial sense. The ego self desperately wants to know. Knowing, in that sense, is a prop. What we so admire as knowing is, in fact, the deepest ignorance. This knowing leads to presumption, pride, and arrogance. It's encapsulated in the saying, knowledge is power. This knowing is the root of all our suffering. It's the barrier between you and intimacy. Not knowing leads to humility, acceptance, and above all, gratitude. Gratitude for the miracle, the mystery, the profound gift of sheer being, the wonder of ordinary reality. We have to give up transitory knowing for not knowing. Not knowing is the real wisdom. We call it prajna. But understand, this prajna does not belong to you or to any person, not even the Buddha. Prajna is the ultimate wisdom of the unknowing universe. We need to learn to live with the unknown intimately and without fear. Learn to see the great void every moment in our everyday lives without falling into nihilistic despair or a kind of complacency. In the midst of life, we are in death. In the midst of death, we are in life. How wonderful to live not knowing is to really live. Contemplate what we call death as the other side of your experience in this moment, the other side of the sheet. See clearly that the unknown other side is in no way separate from what you see, hear, touch, taste, smell, and think in this moment. You are life. You are death. Nothing more. Nothing less. Practice like that and become truly free. And together with all beings, we realize the great way of not knowing.